Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Hi, my name is Bob. Here, I thought he was talking about me till the end there. Let me just start the timer if I can. Okay, there we go. We're started. Wow. Thank you all very much for coming. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes. Excellent. I mean, I really appreciate all of you, and I appreciate so much that knowing that you could be home right now sitting in your underwear reading the New York Times, and instead you're in this giant meat locker with the rest of us. So it's a little chilly. I think if anybody wants to get up and do a couple jumping jacks, just feel free. We'll just move on. You know, I've long dreamed of standing here and sharing my story with you. You know, two weeks ago, it was the classic dream where there were like 10,000 people and I was naked. Classic. And then there was a dream two nights ago where there was this big giant room and there were two people. And they were out there, and they were even texting. So it's been a dream. But I really, you know, this is just my story. It's Al-Anon is in the literature, and this is just my story. And for those of you with the short attention span, I'll just give you the really quick and dirty of how it was, what happened, and how it is now. So my parents were drunks. I married a tweaker, and then my life got a lot better when I came to Al-Anon. So that's what's been happening. Thank you very much. You know, born in New Haven, Connecticut, my dad was a fireman, and he drank shots and beers. My mom was a bookkeeper at the church. Irish Catholics, very, very much into the church. Five kids, I was four out of five. Everybody drank. And when I say that, it was like I didn't know people that didn't drink. Growing up, I never knew people that drank. I do remember I was maybe 10 or 12, somebody came to the house and we went to give them a drink and they didn't drink, and I thought there was something wrong. I thought the person was sick. You know, that's just the environment. It was like gravity and oxygen. It was things that were just there. There was liquor on the cabinet, and like on the counter, next to the flour and sugar and a big bottle of whiskey. That's the house I grew up in. So drinking was there all the time. Nice people, though. They worked really, really hard. My dad, as a fireman, never didn't go to work because he was drinking. He just drank and worked. And the same with my mom. She drank and worked. Which, you know, being a bookkeeper probably didn't work out so well for the church, I'm thinking. Because one day when I was about 15, I came home from school and to find the priest and my mom's doctor and my dad and some of my sisters in the living room with my mom, and they were having an intervention. And my mom, after a lifetime of drinking Manhattans, which are horrible, you know, my mom found AA, which was fantastic. It was really a fantastic change. So my dad kept right on drinking. My dad was never influenced by my mom, and God bless her. I mean, she was never really in Al-Anon, but what a life where she stopped drinking and he just kept right on going. And, you know, she would get him shots and beers, and then she would go off to her meetings. It was remarkable. So mom found AA, and then instead of being an alcoholic, she became a sloganaholic, you know. And everything in the house was plastered with, you know, keep coming back, and, you know, you couldn't grab a pencil. You'd be in school and you'd be like, oh, keep it simple. What's that about? There were keychains. You'd open the pamphlets flying out all over the place. She was real. She went into it with a vengeance, you know, and she wanted us to go too. So she would lure us there by saying, you know, we're going to be going out for ice cream right after this meeting. Why don't you go with us? So, you know, I went to a couple of AA meetings and with my mom and heard these, like, incredible stories, which, you know, decades later still stick with me, of these people's shares. And, but I couldn't, I wasn't ready, you know. A lot of my journey has been not being ready and waiting for that right time to come. You know, I was not ready then. Al-Anon was available. Alateen was available. I just wasn't ready. And so that was kind of my first Al-Anon near miss. I went to those meetings and then kept on going. I just kept right on going with my craziness. You know, I went off to college. I came out. I moved to Boston. I met a guy. And it was the middle of the 80s. So AIDS crisis all around us. I found my first partner. And we just clung on tight to each other. And we hung on to each other for 17 years. And it was great. It was great. He's a beautiful man. He's still around. And he's a great guy. We're not together anymore. I spent, you know, we met in Boston, and we moved out here. We moved to San Francisco. I set into my typical routine of managing, you know, mothering, just manipulating him. And that's how I spent our 17 years together. I was in full-on craziness. This, when I look back about my Al-Anon story, I was a nutcase, you know, and how I was so into somebody else's life. You know, he was a writer, and he was a writer and very mellow and didn't have aspirations of taking over the world. But I had aspirations for him to take over the world. I needed him to get like a better job and do something and write the great novel. I needed that to happen. So I kept trying to make that happen for 17 years. And I would, you know, he would occasionally, he was often unemployed or underemployed, and he'd say, oh, maybe I'll go get a job. Maybe I'll work in Starbucks. I'm going to go work in Starbucks. And I'd say, no, don't work in Starbucks. I'd rather keep working more. So you don't have to work in Starbucks, because then you'd be unhappy. You know, fucking nuts. Just, you're trying to kind of fix his life. I was also, you know, just, I was so controlling. I would work all day, and then I'd come home, and I'd go do the food shopping. Now, he wasn't working. He could have gone food shopping. But I wanted to do the food shopping because I wanted it done my way. And then I would come home, then I'd go food shopping and be a maniac in Safeway, throwing things in a basket. And my favorite Al-Anon crazy bit was, like, I'd go shopping at Safeway, and I'd go up to the checkout, and I'd put things on the conveyor belt the way I wanted them put in the bag. Heavy, 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 light, light, light. Heavy, 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 light, light, light. Really? Really? Let it go. And then I'd come home and I'd cook. I'd cook too. So I work, go food shopping, come home and cook. Why? Because I like to cook? No, I don't really like to cook. I can cook. It's all right, but I don't like it. I wanted it done my way, you know. And after years of this, after like decades of this, you know, I didn't have tools to communicate how I was feeling. I had no idea how I was feeling. I just knew I was unhappy. You know, I was unhappy that I was working so much and he wasn't. I was unhappy that he wasn't living the life I wanted him to live. I was unhappy that, you know, our sex life was crap. It just sucked because I couldn't communicate what I wanted. And one day after about 12 years, I was just so at the end of my rope that I wrote a letter. And I couldn't say it, so I just typed up a letter. And I took it, and I knew he was going to be out for a while. So I took the letter and I put it on the pillow. And I went out for a long walk. And I went out for like 2 hours. And I knew he was on his way home. And it was so scary for me to like write up about what I needed and how it wasn't working and how I was afraid and I wanted to change our relationship and I needed things to be different. And I left that letter and I went out and I was really scared about what was going to happen when I came home and we had to really talk about it. And I came home. And I went in the bedroom, and I was picked up. It was still there. And just as I was holding it in my hand, the key turned in the lock, and I could hear him come in behind me. And I took that letter, and I hid it. I put it away. And we never talked. We never talked about that letter. He never saw that letter. 5 years later, we ended up breaking up. It was just, we continued to fight. All the issues were the same. All the issues were exactly the same. But I didn't have the courage to talk about it. And 5 years later, when we broke up after 17 years together, and I'm standing alone in my, half-empty house, because half of the stuff went off with him, I find this letter, and really it was a low point in my life at that point, that there was so much that I couldn't say. It was right there. It was all right here on a piece of paper. And I just couldn't say it. And I think back, if I had been able to say, if I had been able to find the courage and the tools to talk and say what was the problems, maybe things would have been different. But they weren't. They weren't. And we were, and we broke up, and I had a huge hole in my heart, and I had a huge hole in my life, which I went out and decided to try to fill with money and things and travel, and it says here whoring in my notes. Just for a little bit, I'm sure. It wasn't too bad. Year or two. I was profoundly, profoundly sad. And the culmination of the, if you want to know loneliness, for me, the culmination of my loneliness was on Thanksgiving Day. Thanksgiving Day, I went to a great Thanksgiving dinner with some friends, and I got home early, and then I went online and started tricking online again. I mean, really tricking on Thanksgiving? That is sad. And that's when I met my second partner. And he had just features. He was a project. Recovering drug addict, 10 years clean, performance artist, Hawaiian performance artist, he was brown performance artist. I'm like a white guy from Connecticut working for an investment firm. We made a lovely couple. We would walk down the sidewalk together, and people would look, and they'd go, so we met, and there were, things were crazy. We were different. But one thing that I got from him, which was fantastic, is that one day he took me to a drag show. We're going to a drag show. Won't that be fun? It's drag bingo. It's going to be great. I'm like, all right, whatever. It was, of course, a fundraiser for Living Sober. So that is actually how I found Al-Anon. I went to a drag show, and there was a meeting before, and there was this drag queen up there speaking. Drag queen, somebody was in this room right now. And I heard this message, and I couldn't, I was so sobbing inside. It was all I could do to contain myself. Just hearing the promises and hearing the steps made me so profoundly sad. I knew that there was something like really missing in my life. And I knew that I had to start going to meetings. So I did. So I started going to the Yahoo meeting. I went like once a week religiously. It was great. I didn't do anything else. I just went to that meeting. And then I got myself a sponsor, because we're supposed to have a sponsor. So I went and got myself a sponsor, and that was good. So check sponsor. About 3 months later, I'm walking down the street, and I run into my sponsor on the street, and she says, "Hey, hi. You can call me sometime, because we're supposed to talk. This is how the sponsor thing works. You talk, and I talk, we talk. That's how, you can't just have a sponsor." So things got better. So I had a great program with her. I was like, I'm going to meet with her, and we're going to 12 steps, 12 weeks maybe, and we'll knock these things out. Maybe 14 if she needs a little time. She was exactly the sponsor I needed, because she was fierce, and she was not on my schedule. We were on her schedule, and we were going to go through the steps one word at a time. The first week, we. Let's talk about we. Who do you think we are? Oh my God. Powerless took 2 weeks because that's a compound word. Really? It was tough going, but it was exactly what I needed. So I worked with that sponsor for about a year. But you know, now I'm in Al-Anon. I'm with my partner, and things are kind of okay. You know, I'm not cured because I'm in Al-Anon. It's just the beginning of understanding how things are fucked up. You know, when we argue and we have issues, I remember, you know, he's still in program and I'm in program. And I remember one time we went to this kayak regatta. So in Sausalito, they have this kayak regatta. I'm a big kayaker. I love it. And they have this, like, 1,000 kayaks go out on the bay for this one party once a year. And I really wanted to do it. And he wasn't a kayaker, but he was, you know, he was willing to do it. Of course, he wasn't paying attention. We went there. He didn't listen. He was on the phone when they were giving instructions, and he had never, you know, it was just, he wasn't really into it, and he finally, like, agreed. So if you ever want to test a relationship, get a double kayak with your partner, because nothing, you're on the water, okay, so you could die at any second. You know, you have to work together. The person in the front sets the pace. The person in the back gets to steer. It's a relationship, you know, you have to make it work. He was decided this is how you do it. He's paddling, and I'm banging, and I'm so frustrated with him. We're out with all these people on the bay, and I am just losing my mind. It's just crazy. He's not paying attention. I'm so pissed off and screaming at him. And just then, in front of us, this giant, like 30-foot, huge motorboat comes and sails, like, right in front of us. And on the back of it, in 2-foot high letters, it says, SS Serenity. No word of a lie. It's exactly what happened. And I tap him on the shoulder. I'm like, see, there's your boat right there. Look at that. That was, of course, my boat. And I didn't get that boat. I let it go by. I was in such a crazy place in denial. And, you know, our lives were, it was difficult, and then it got more difficult. He lost his job, and I was manipulating him like crazy now, because I had, again, I had all the money, and he had no money. And I put him on my insurance, and now he got access to all these new doctors. And I said his old ghetto doctor that he used to work with was no good, and he should go to these new doctors that he could go to on my insurance. Wouldn't that be great? So he goes off to this new doctor, and then he had lost his job, and he hurt himself, and all these things happened. And next thing we know, that he had convinced his doctor to give him painkillers for his hurt, and convinced his doctor to give him some medication for attention deficit syndrome, which is effectively speed. Now, I don't blame the doctor, and neither does he. Nobody blames anybody. There's no blame. It's just what happened. And so over the course of the next couple of years, he kept getting quirkier and quirkier in my mind. I didn't see it coming. I didn't see it when the first time he overdosed on painkillers and I found him in the living room. I didn't see it the second time he overdosed on painkillers. And I found him, and I had to call 911. I didn't know what to do. I called 911, and I'm on the phone, and he kind of comes around enough to beg me to hang up the phone. Don't call 911, because if I call 911 and he's overdosed on painkillers, they're going to think he tried to kill himself, and they're going to 5250 him. They're going to put him in the psych ward for 3 days, and he begs me not to do it. So I hang up on 911. And you have a prize for this person. Get her a blanket, because she is correct. They call back. They do. They know it. They got your number. I don't know how. It's magic. They call back, and then you're in a position of lying to them and saying, no, it's okay. And you hang up the phone, and it rings again. And then he's begging me, and they call back again, and I say, I can't talk, I'm putting him in the car, I'm driving him to Davies, and I hang up the phone. And then I just stay with him. And, you know, I tell you that part of the story because it is such a level of denial. The denial that you can, who can't see that? I didn't know. I honestly didn't know. Smart guy, college educated, have a big job, didn't figure it out. I didn't get it. I didn't get it the third time he overdosed. I didn't get it when he was freaking out and staying out all night. I didn't get it when he didn't come home one night and I went driving around the city looking for him. I didn't get it. I still thought something was off. The level of denial in this disease is just mind-blowing. Until one day, it was Halloween night, and he was really freaking out, and he admitted to me that he was shooting drugs. And I said, you have to leave. And he had no job, and he had no money, and now he was addicted to drugs, and I threw him out on the street, and that's what happened. And it was horrible. It was horrible for everybody. Horrible for him. Horrible when I changed the locks. Horrible when he tried to, you know, break in the apartment. Horrible that night at 4:30 in the morning when he broke in through the garage and was down banging around underneath the house in the storeroom, and I had to call the police. I didn't just call the police. I was alone. I was in bed. It's 4:30 in the morning, and he's downstairs, and I'm terrified, terrified that he's going to come up into the house. And but then I realized I wasn't alone. You know, I had all of you. And so I called one of you, and you told me that I should call the police. And so I did. And I called the police, and two squad cars showed up, and we had to go. I'd take him into the garage, and they handcuffed my former husband and took him off somewhere. And I couldn't have done that without you, you know. I couldn't have done that without you. And then, you know, that was a real low point too. And things have gotten much better, you know. I kept going on. I kept going to meetings. I had my sponsor, you know. I met new people. I met another partner after that. I met a partner here in the rooms. And interesting, like the opening speaker from this weekend talked about, she met her partner in the rooms. And she mentioned something that we do, which is we live our relationship one day at a time, you know. And it's not always easy. Often I would just love it if he would just, you know, scream and throw a pot like a normal person. Fuck you! Never happens. It's worse. We have to sit down and talk about it. Really? It's terrible, but great. It's fantastic. My life is so much better because I live one day at a time in a much more real and authentic way now. You know, I'm still friends with my first partner and my second partner. My second partner is now, I think he's about a year and a half clean, I think, you know. And we talk from time to time. You know, things can move on, you know. You don't have to cut people out of your life, I've found. So I think one thing I'd like to share just a little bit on towards just a few more minutes is about how I find the program and how I see the program. You know, it says in one of the readings that it's a spiritual practice. And for me, the operative word there is practice. You know, I used to do yoga. I did yoga for like, you know, 2 or 3 years. And now I haven't done it for like 4 or 5 years. You know, it doesn't work. I'm not limber. Look at this. That's it. That's as far as I go. You have to practice. You have to do it every day. Well, then one of the speakers last night said, you know, you can't ski on last year's snow. You know, it's great that you were in program last year. That's fabulous. What did you do today? And today, you guys are all here. You guys got up, you got out of bed, you got dressed, you put the paper down, and you came downtown, and you came to a meeting, which is fantastic. So I think you should all be very proud of that. You're working your program. You're practicing your program. You know, there's tons of opportunity to practice in the program, to practice doing what we do. Sponsorship is one. Who in here has a sponsor? Who in here is a sponsor? Great. You know, In both of those ways, we get to practice stuff, get to practice our boundaries. I used to think it was such bullshit before, you know, that you will learn so much more from your sponsees. That just sounds like that can't be true. But it is. It is true. I love my sponsees, and I love that I have that opportunity to practice my boundaries and practice listening, to practice being there for somebody, and not fixing them. Because I need that practice. I really need that practice. I'm really good. I got 45 years of managing people. You go over here, you step over there. I can manage people. You know, letting people live their lives and be themselves, that I need a lot of practice in. So if you're not sponsoring somebody, I think you should really give that a look and really think about it for yourself. It's a gift to yourself that you get to practice that. I think another thing, and you've heard a lot about it tonight, this weekend, is service. The thing that I've noticed, or I've been thinking about a lot in terms of service, is the people that have been putting on this fantastic conference for all of us. I like to think of them as being different. You know, that they're different. They're like somehow smarter and have like more time on their hands. You know, they have huge organizational capability, and that they just can do stuff that I could never do. That is not correct. Sorry.
You get a blanket.
Bring it. They are exactly like you and you and you and you. They're exactly like all of us. Except what they have that some of us don't have is that they have courage. They are not afraid to let go, right? They're not free. I've lived a lot of my life tentative. You know, I'm very tentative in my life. You know, when I was a kid learning how to swim, I was holding on to the edge of the pool, kicking my legs, saying, "Look, I'm swimming, I'm swimming, I'm swimming." You know, and I've lived much of my life like that, holding on to the edge of the pool. You know, you don't get to live life very well like that. You don't get to see a lot when you're holding on to the edge. You've got to let go. And I think doing service is a way you can practice that. You can practice letting go and trying something. And, you know, it's going to be okay. You know, it's going to be okay. You can be on a committee. You can try to help out. You can do service, and it will be okay. Clearly, you can do it imperfectly, right? You know? You can make mistakes. It's okay. And I think service is a tremendous opportunity. So for you to try to practice that courage, to practice your program, to let go of whatever it is that's holding you on, let go of that fear that's keeping you. What is it? Why? Why don't you want to do service? You're really that busy? Really? I would invite you all to think about that and to think about how you can expand your own program. This is for you, your own program, by doing some service. So I think I would say that the scary stuff is where the growth is. It has been for me, and I invite you to try that. I want to close with just two other things. You know, my mom was very religious, and I 16 years of Catholic education, and at the end of that, I was like, I want none of it. You know, I don't want anything to do with God. God was like, no, I didn't want it. And that was a big barrier for me coming into program. It took me a while to get over the whole God thing. And then one day I realized something. It was ringing in my mind from something my mom had said like 30 years before, was that her prayer for me, she knew I didn't like the Catholic Church and religion, but her prayer for me was that someday I would find something in my life that worked for me as well as her religion worked for her. You know, she didn't tell me to go to church. She just said she hoped I'd find something that worked as well for me. And I have. Here in program. So for for all of that, I'd like to thank all of you and thank you for coming out this morning. And thank you for being the audience of my dreams. So.
Hi, my name is Steve, and I am indeed a very grateful member of Al-Anon. Hi, everyone. So I'm going to tell a joke at the beginning. And it involves the devil. And let me explain who that person is. It's not of any particular gender. The devil is part of an anonymous underworld program, which is not allied with any sect or denomination. The person is often thought of as evil, but the person really did the best he could under the circumstances. So, Daddy and Mommy and Stevie are in the car, and they're on vacation. They're driving along a mountain road, and off they go and crash and die. It's just a story. So the devil comes up to Daddy and says, How did you get here? Daddy says, well, you know, had a few drinks and went off the cliff. Devil goes up to Mommy and says, How did you get here? And she said, he was drinking and we went off the cliff. And Daddy says, yeah, but she drove me to it. The devil goes up to Stevie and says, well, how did you get here? And Stevie says, I'm not here, and it's not hot. You got it. Okay. You got it. Paradox. Welcome to my life. I have to tell a secret. Part of that paradox is several living sobers ago, I was sitting down there, and I went, oh, I could do that. I can speak. And I'll do the best job ever because I'll prepare for it. And that is such an unrealistic thing. Duh. And at the same time as, what the heck am I doing up here right now? And that's the paradox that I live with. It's these two things that make no sense together, but welcome to my life. And for some of us, welcome to our lives. It's that denial and awareness dance that I go through. And as it was read earlier, no longer terrified, we are free to delight in life's paradox, mystery, and awe. I'm from Chicago, that great American city that divides alcohol from beer and wine. And it's just not the signs on the liquor stores, where they actually have some stores that sell beer and wine, but not alcohol. But it's a psychological thing too. My family, if you took whiskey and you put 7-Up or ginger ale in it, it wasn't alcohol. It was a cocktail. So beer, wine, cocktails, but we're not alcoholic. I'm an only child. There's a program for that. And, you know, I hear the shares through the years of the different roles that children have to play. And I got all of them, as did some of you. And I was a surrogate for my mother and my father. So there was this wicked triad that kept going on. And if I was having time with Dad, Mom would assert herself. And if I was having time with Mom, Dad would just sit on the sidelines. And so I never had really a complete relationship with either one of them, still being an only child. I developed an acute awareness that I needed to have antenna to figure out what they were not saying to me. What is it that they wanted? And I will tell you, that antenna really worked very well, and does to this day, with my mother and my father, who have both died, and it doesn't work with you all. I try. I want you to understand what's going on. I want to figure it out, but that antenna doesn't work. All of my family on both sides had this antenna. We're of East European stock, and that what that means, kind of, sort of, is that we're very quiet. We're very lower middle class, and we're worried about what other people think of us. And it manifests itself in very weird ways, like plastic covers on the sofa, plastic covers on the car seats, plastic covers on our emotions. Neither my father or my mother are alcoholic, which is kind of strange to me because I feel now that I so belong in here. But they come from that stock where everybody there had basements, and everybody there had a second refrigerator in that basement, which was had to be stocked with beer. If we were down to one case, you were running low. You may not have had on your social calendar that family or friends were coming over, but you had to go out to the beer wine store and get another two cases of beer and often have them stacked up. I remember as a child sitting on cases of beer if I went down to the basement and played. You know, we were the only family that didn't have the refrigerator, but we had the stacks of cases of beer because you had to be prepared. It was also a family of a lot of secrets. And it was part of the really caring about what other people think of you to the extreme. We've had numerous young ones, 1, 2 years old, that died and then were just never talked about. Pictures would get buried. Cousins, aunts, and uncles, through the generations. We have, at last count, 3 sets of first cousins who married. East Europeans, it's like, you know, Appalachia, forget it. We can outdo you. I always wondered why the last names were so always the same. Like, what is this? I want to tell one story about my grandparents, my father's parents. It was their 50th anniversary, and we were going to have a big celebration, and all the cousins, and I'm the oldest in that, were going to chip in, and we were really looking forward to this. It's going to be a big family reunion. It's a huge family on that side. But they didn't have a marriage certificate for my grandparents. So my aunt, who was a bigwig in Chicago, went and searched for it and found the marriage certificate. My aunt's the second oldest, and she looked at the date of the certificate and her birth date and went, these are kind of close. Because my father, who was the oldest, she knew his birth date, was really close to the date of the marriage. So this whole celebration that we're all looking for forward to came crashing down. It stopped. Nobody said anything. It's a family secret. We're not going to talk about it. Yeah. What celebration? La, 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 la. It wasn't going to happen because my dad was already in the womb when they got married. And finally, I found a picture of my grandmother, who's a tall woman, and she had this bouquet that had this huge doily thing with flowers that Alejandro would have been wonderful to carry down, I know. And she's holding it like this. So there's this big circle, and then there's this stomach that goes beyond it. And you know, thank God for faxing, and I had some phone numbers of my cousins because we got a good kick out of that. And it's like, but you know, it was this horrible thing that happened to the family, and we were like, what? All of that energy spent on keeping the secrets was so much more detrimental than the amount of celebration we could have had. Welcome to my life. I never had a friend over for lunch or dinner. It wasn't until I hit my 40s where I really realized that. No kids from the neighborhood, from school, ever came over for lunch or dinner or a sleepover or even to go down to the basement and play inside. It never happened. I didn't know I was missing something. This is a disease of choices and opportunities. I didn't know I had the opportunity. It's the paradox. I was missing something, and I kind of knew it, but I didn't know I had the choice to actually do something about it. Food was served on the platter. There was no help yourself. Here's what you're going to eat. You finish it all. You don't ask for seconds. It didn't feel like I was being psychologically whipped, but I was. Basic choices that I didn't have. I would come out of the shower in the morning, get ready for school, and my clothes would be laid out on my bed. Unfortunately, at the time, I was going to the University of Illinois and driving there. So I didn't grow up with the alcoholic father or mother, but I certainly grew up with their disease because they are both adult children of alcoholics. And I know that I can be some of the most dangerous people around. Because it just wasn't clear to me. When I would hear stories after I got in recovery of the violence that would happen in your relationships, I have to tell you, I was jealous because it was something, anything. When I would be at someone's house, I remember being over a workmate's house, and the wine was just flowing freely, and the front room was actually the dining room, and the door was propped wide open, even though it was winter, and the neighbors were coming in and out and eating spaghetti and drinking the wine and screaming at each other and throwing things, and I thought I was at the circus. I wanted that so bad. I wanted that so bad because this is what I had. I had this shut down life. Fortunately for me, there was some higher power intervention in that I was lucky enough to hang around with a whole bunch of people that were in recovery or were about to get into recovery back in Chicago. And it really was, I was attracted to what they had. I didn't know what they had. I didn't know they had something. I didn't know it was attractive, but I was. And it took moving to San Francisco to kind of jar the system and get into program. I was primed for that, but it really took the biggest addict in my life, somebody who I played music with, and we would just finish each other's sentences literally and musically. To finally just one day, out of context, turn to me and go, "You need Al-Anon," and he was right. So I can't say I had a big about coming into program, but you know, a big addict tells the codependent about you need Al-Anon. I said, "Okay, yes, sir, I will go." And It was the magic of being in that and not quite hearing my story, but sensing this is the right place and the right time for me. But I couldn't quite figure it out because my dad and my mom weren't alcoholics. I wasn't married to one. And it took years in the program to realize that everybody in my family, other than my mom and dad, drank. And because we were a shut down family, they would drink and they'd be happy. I don't know if they were joyous and free, but they were happy and I adored them. I remember a few years ago on my bucket list was to tell one of my cousins how much I adored her parents, who were always very, very wonderful and warm and touchy with me. And I said, "Marilyn, I just have to tell you this. I really, really loved your parents." And she looked at me and she said, "The drunks." What? I got back at her because she became caretaker for my mother. I was a world champion people pleaser because my parents really didn't tell me what they needed, and I developed those antennae to go after that. I had to please them. I had to please them. I didn't know what that was, but I became very, very good at it. The reward of it wasn't that great, but it becomes very good. Became very good at it. And as I started venturing out into life, I still was that world champion people pleaser, except it didn't work like it did at home. So I just had to try a little harder because that, of course, will put all of everything into a place. And when I realized, and I thought this has only been somewhat recently, I realized that when I people please, my energy is not in pleasing you and bringing you into my life. My energy is into keeping you from going away. So maybe some of you need to go away, like some of my ex-boyfriends. But, you know, I would keep on with them. That energy of keeping people from running away and not drawing them in meant that I was liked with a small L by almost everybody. But I wasn't really liked, because I wasn't doing anything that was going to be truly me, that some of you would go, God, he's great, and some of you would go, eh. It was a pablum. It was like oatmeal without anything else in it, just bland. And that's what I thought I had to do. So I walked into Al-Anon, and it took a while before I heard my story, and I finally did. And I finally realized that this is the place. And if it looked like a rose and smelled like a rose and stung like a rose, it was probably a rose. And I was lucky to have some people share early on with me their experience on this too. The problem was, as I came in, I was pretty smart. I'm not smarter than anybody in this room, but I've heard other people say this. So I tried to smart my way through Al-Anon. It's like, well, because my parents aren't alcoholic, I'm not as bad as you, so I don't need to make phone calls. You know, I'm going to read a pamphlet. I don't need to read literature. I need to get a sponsor. He's cute. That didn't work. And then I picked a sponsor who was very popular. And I thought, well, maybe I could get on the in crowd and get on the popular sponsor. But he had, you know, 27 sponsees, and he worked 3 programs. Like, I was going to get time, and I didn't know how to really to work a program and be assertive and say, this is what I want, this is what I need. I was, you know, the sponsor was my new parent. If I didn't, what do you want me to do? I also got hooked up with some people, God bless them, who were smarting their way through, so we just thought we were just so smart. That is the quick road to become the Al-Anon police. I still wear that, and I am working diligently on getting rid of that, because I am not your higher power as much as I would like to be. Those first several years in Al-Anon, I call Steven-on, because I was my own higher power. I got programmed by osmosis because I had my ass in the chair, but I really didn't work it like it would work me back. Osmosis. After about 6-7 years, I thought I graduated. You know, people had long-term program. I wasn't listening to their shares, and when I was getting a little bored, and thought I had everything together. And just, I didn't make a conscious decision, it's time to leave Al-Anon, but you make a choice. I think I'm going to watch TV tonight, so go to a meeting. And next thing you know, I was outside of the meetings for some years. What I wasn't told is that the family disease of alcoholism is cunning, baffling, and powerful. And while I don't choose to act out my addictions through alcohol, not having program and not working it with my level of disease was very dangerous. And I looked around at my life and said, this ain't working, and I can't put my finger on why. And I was starting to get more and more depressed and more lonely and alone and isolating and putting up a good front and started people-pleasing. And I went, oh, wait, I know what this is like. I've done this. I've done this for decades. And I got some semblance of recovery in these rooms by working a program, albeit by osmosis. But I did some work, and I got some recovery, and it felt like I lost it. And something just, I wanted to quit smoking, and I went to the Lion Martin Quit Smoking Clinic, and they suggested adding on a 12-step program. And that little comment went, ding, go back to Al-Anon. And I went back to my home meeting, and I said, I'm going to do this a little bit differently than I've done it before. I'm going to work it. It's not a 12-meeting program. It's a 12-step program. It's not a 12-slogan program. It's a 12-step program. How you work it is up to you, but I decided I really wanted to work it. And I said, I need a kick-ass sponsor. And I came to Living Sober, and I heard someone speak and went, ah, this is the person. And so after the meeting was kind of done, I waddled my way up, and a person in this program who I really admire was standing on the side, and I went up to him and I went, I'm going to ask her to be my sponsor. And he looked up at her, and he looked at me, and he looked up at her, and he looked at me, and he said, I think that's a great idea. What I didn't know was he was her sponsor. And she was higher power. And she had shared that she wanted a gung-ho sponsee that she could work with and was going to turn it over and come to Living Sober. So it was a match. It was a match made in a meeting. And she kicked my ass. Here's some things that I've really learned from working this program and from the shares that you've given me. Figuring it out is not a slogan. First time I heard that years ago, I was in that big Monday night meeting, and you know, and then there's 100 people there, and 50 people went, what? What you think of me is none of my business. Damn. That's a hard one to let go of. There's a lot of payback for me. But what you think of me is none of my business. Detaching with love, or manners, or an axe with an amends attached to the handle later on, if that's what I've got to do. What's my part in it? My side of the street. I no longer confuse love and pity. And that's both ways. It's me too. Like, how do I get you into my life by having you pity me? I've done it. I no longer am confusing forgiving and forgetting. I would bring someone in my life who would, not their fault, I'm the doormat, stomp all over me, and then I would build this resentment and never forgive you. But I would forget that you do it, and I'd invite you in the next day. And just playing that cycle over and over again. Saying no, period. Saying no to good people. Saying no to job opportunities. And this is blowing up right now on something, the job that I'm quitting, because it doesn't work for me. Saying no to good people because we're just not meant for each other. Saying no to one situation versus another where they're both good. It took me a long time to go, this is a bad one, this is a bad one, to realize I didn't need either one. When I have two good situations and I can only choose one, I'm learning how to do that. And it's an amazing gift of this program. This is a new one somebody's given me, and this actually came in through Alateen. A higher power small enough for me to understand is not big enough to handle my problems. Oh. A higher power small enough for me to understand is not big enough to handle my problems. I found the off button. There's an off button that when I start spinning, I can hit the off button. I know how to do that now. When I start obsessing, when I start going into fear, or start when I'm in it, there's an off button. And that may be just saying, I know what this is, Steve, stop. It may be saying the Serenity Prayer one or 20 times. It may be doing the steps 1, 2, and 3 waltz over and over again. I have on my desk at work a button. It says easy on it. It's from an office supply store that shall remain anonymous. And one of the ways that I practice my program at work is attraction. So that I was in one of my coworkers' offices working, figuring out his computer and downloading some stuff on it, and he had Faint, Thoughtful, Honest, Intelligent, Necessary, and Kind up in the center of his wall, and I know where he got that from because I happened to mention that at a meeting when we were all like cussing out somebody. And I said, ugh. And I'm seeing this more and more, just my workmates. So I have this button sitting on my desk, and when I run into a problem, and it isn't like a work, you know, how do I do this thing, but it's more of the core issue stuff. When I have that and I stop, work my program around it, then I go,
that was easy.
And now I've got others coming by, like when they have something similar, they'll come running out to my desk. That was easy. Because it's true. I didn't know that. I didn't know that some of the stuff that's so paradoxically difficult could be actually that easy once I've worked the program. I have a current sponsor who I adore. And what was interesting is my previous sponsor had left the program. It's out of my control. She decided to leave. And I was sitting there thinking, like, who can I ask? Let's take all the cute ones and put them away. I'm not going to ask them. Take all the really popular ones that I see, you know, with their 47 sponsees and move them out. But who do I admire? And I got a phone call from someone that said, let's have dinner. It's like, yeah, I've never had dinner with you. Let's go do this. And it turned out she had the same sponsor I did. And we both said, So I have a great co-sponsor now. And I heartily recommend that if you've got a big year on your chip and you're finding, you know, some problems getting a sponsor, find somebody to co-sponsor. I have to put a plug in. I haven't found anywhere in literature it says you can only have one sponsor. I just want to say that. You know, you have different needs for different things. Go use it. One of the things that I really love about this program is the way it's a playground for me. It's a laboratory, and it's real life. When I first thought about practicing these principles in all my affairs, and then would hear that, well, I need affairs to practice them in, and that's true. Yeah. But I saw it, you know, that either-or thinking that there's this line. So, you know, I'll come over here and be Al-Anon and be healthy and hear all this stuff, and now I have to go over here outside of Al-Anon, completely divorced from that, and make friends over here and expect them to know when I'm speaking Al-Anon what I'm talking about. I found out that that's for me, an unnecessary boundary, and that when I make friends, and I don't use that word lightly, because I haven't known how to do that from my upbringing. But when I make friends, I'm finding that it's not easy, it's the best way is to hear the shares in the meetings, meeting after meeting, week after week, month after month, and know that that person has something that I want. And I may have something that they want. And just go out for coffee. I found so much of doing fellowship in this program. And I want to close by my previous sponsor had, she was a ritualist, as am I. I'm going into much about that, but she wanted me to write something about fellowship. And we're going to go out to the beach and watch the sunset. And I wrote this, and this is the way I really kind of feel about you. This is not Al-Anon approved literature, but it's from me. I love the way that you walk in front of me, holding your experienced hand out to me, leading the way to new and fearless paths. I love the way that you walk behind me, letting me find my own strength with a nudge of encouragement and a word of hope. I love the way that we walk beside each other step by step, sharing our concerns and joys, our slips and our insights, letting us just be in our serenity. The paradox is that it's an honor to be in this program with you. And it's a necessity to be in this program with you. When I am spinning, when I am slipping, and I am on my own and have nothing else to turn to, the three steps. 1, 2, and 3, over and over again. If I can't do that, it's step one. It's just step one. If I can't do that, it's the first word of the first step, which is the most important one of all of them to me, and that is we. I am so grateful that I have become a part of we here.
That was easy.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.